I'm Ryan, I'm an addict. Hey, y'all. I've been trying to catch up with this guy ever since I got here today. He still ain't. I guess I could have called him, though. That never occurred to me. A little slow. I was sitting here trying to, they just told me I'd do this a few minutes ago. 10 or 12 years ago, I don't know exactly, and I'm horrible with time, you know. I told somebody this, we went to Don Euler's 40-year birthday the other night, and on the way back, I told him, I said, man, one of my big regrets is I didn't go see Billy Joel and Elton John when they were on tour together, and I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. We Googled it, it was 94. Been more than 4 or 5 years, okay? But I'm guessing this is 10 or 12 years ago. Ed called myself and Rusty and Don and invited us to come to this thing in Atlanta called NA History Rising. And we went and saw these guys for the first time, and they just blew us away. And I've gotten to see them a couple of times since then. I think Chris is here by himself this weekend. I don't think Boyd is here, but they do a tremendous history presentation, and y'all know that me and Don and Rusty are kind of history guys too, so we just were really fascinated by that. And the last time I saw them was at the World Convention in Orlando, you know, and they did this deal in front of several thousand people. You know, it's pretty cool. But I strongly encourage you to be here at 10:30 in the morning. I don't have no idea what he's going to do, but I guarantee you it will be interesting and entertaining. I've never heard his story. We've talked on the phone maybe half a dozen times over the course of the years, but I'm really looking forward to the chance to get to know him a little better. And if I could look at him and know who I'm looking at, that would be good too. There, okay, he's got a mask on. No damn wonder I can't figure out who it is. I give you Chris B. from North Carolina.
My name is Chris, I'm an addict. This is my first in-person convention since February of 2020. And it's really nice to be here with you. I work at a facility, and we've had 143 COVID cases in January, and I just want to be careful to not spread anything besides the message of recovery. Thanks to the convention committee for the opportunity to come here originally to present NA history, and then for the invitation to speak tonight. It's still up in the air what I'll present tomorrow. Kind of one input, if people want to hear the early story, the basic text, just let me know and I'll be happy to accommodate. History is important. This was shared with me recently. It says, when you know your history, you know your value. You know the price that has been paid for you to be here. You recognize what those who came before you built and sacrificed for you to inhabit the space in which you dwell. And the gift of recovery through Narcotics Anonymous is a result of sacrifice of many other addicts. And the only price for me or for us in here today is to pass that on to someone else. Profound grace to be standing here clean today. Tough week. Tuesday, John, suicide. Wednesday, Jordan, overdose. Thursday, Kyle, overdose. This morning, Angelina, overdose. Sitting in here with you guys with this gift for today. And how do I choose to honor that gift, that opportunity? I find it to be incredibly bizarre to tell my story, because I've been clean since 1990, and when I came in as a young person, I could not envision attending meetings for more than a year. And the person that I was then, I wonder what he would think about the person today. If he would be able, like, I want to make sure that I share something that wouldn't scare the heck out of 19-year-old Chris, you know. I'm kind of probably a little bit all over the place, but I will say a couple things that I think have been important. One is I've kind of come to understand that, you know, we have a message in Narcotics Anonymous, and that an addict, any addict, can stop using, can lose the desire and find a new way to live. And there's a few things with that, because when I came in young, and my first meeting was in 1987 at age 16, when I came in young, there were a lot of reservations. And what I was able to discover, most by looking back, what I was able to discover is that I was able to stay clean despite reservations. And I think the reason was, is one of the things that it says in our basic text, and this is, I use a fifth edition, and it's in We Do Recover. So it's page 88 in the fifth, it's probably a few pages later in the sixth. But it says, we do not have to understand this program for it to work. All we have to do is follow direction. And that really guided me during a time that allowed me to work through reservations. The gifts are that I have stopped using. I don't have a desire to use. I'm not plagued by the obsession. I'm still on this path of trying to learn a new way of life, you know. So I was born in Maryland, and I grew up between those two states that were difficult to pronounce. I grew up in Rhode Island, which is between Connecticut and Massachusetts. I'm the oldest of three, I think probably the first significant thing that happened that set kind of a theme for me, which was of kind of a profound sense of isolation and feeling apart from, which, you know, I felt identification when I came to Narcotics Anonymous and heard other addicts say, you know, I never felt a part of, or, you know, I always felt different. But when I was 8, I had a pretty significant head injury. Kid threw a brick off a garage roof and hit me in the side of the head. We were actually at that time in Minnesota for 9 months, and I was a new kid in a new neighborhood and a new school, and I ended up at the, not right away, but I ended up at the hospital for a week, and then had a shaved head and had a horseshoe shaped scar. And they really want to caution, you know, and protect you from further head injury when you've had one. So as a new kid in this new school, I got to wear a hockey helmet. And the kids would go out at recess to play, and I'd put on my hockey helmet and go to the library. And so that, you know, that just, that was one of the early kind of experiences where I felt very different and very isolated. My story is also about dealing with a lot of depression. I don't know what the origins of it were, but at a young age, dealt with a lot of depression, and you know, apparently at one point, I kind of asked my dad when I was 10 or 11, you know, is this all there is to life? So when I got introduced to drugs when I was 12, I remember that the first time that I got high, what happened is that I felt alive inside, and that was something that I hadn't experienced before. And it was so impactful that it became something that I wanted to re-experience. And when I talk about grace, in some ways, it's a story of two tales of two kids that started using together who ended up with very different experiences, one in recovery, one not. So my friend Stephen, you know, whenever I tell my story, I can't tell it without thinking about him. And again, you know, grace and gratitude, and then kind of a sense of obligation and responsibility that comes along with that. I've had this opportunity for recovery. How do I try to use it to do the most good? I started dealing with a lot of kind of suicidal thoughts and some, you know, small attempts as I was 14, 15. Had a lot of pain inside. And these are things, you know, like I never necessarily talking about, but, you know, if there weren't drugs, I would find other ways to deal with the pain, and that might be hurting myself in some way, with, you know, cutting myself, burning myself, etc. And when I do tell that stuff out loud, I just realize how far I've kind of come. But a lot of pain and a lot of, you know, difficulties. Overdose, emergency department, conversations about institutionalization, sent to counselors, that was kind of both via family and the school system. When I was 15, my grandfather passed away, and so we would go back to Maryland to see my grandmother regularly, and on one of those trips, I had a friend go with me, and we slept downstairs next to the bar. And the second night, a couple things happened. One, he had made sexual advances at me, or towards me. And also, he had thrown up on the carpet, and I'd passed out. When I woke up, I was like, discovered this, and I gotta solve this. I gotta clean this. And my mom had recently said, like, Chris, if you ever come across vomit, use. And I had ammonia and I had bleach. And I couldn't finish the sentence, you know. Which one? And I tell you, I chose wrong. And I discovered quickly when I poured bleach on that green rug. Two things happened for that. My grandmother kicked the family out of the house. Like, you're not welcome. You're disrespecting my husband's home, his memory, you know, blah, blah, blah. That was painful, you know. And then the second thing was talking to this guy and saying, hey, you know, you said some things and, you know, he denied it and so forth. But then we get back to Rhode Island, and within a month or two, you know, people are coming up to me saying they heard what I tried to do to him. And so I became the F word and things like that. And again, pretty isolated and alienated from folks. And then maybe a month after that, my dad gathers us one morning and says, yeah, I'm leaving tomorrow. And so it just was a lot of anger, a lot of pain. And using was a way that made me feel alive. And, you know, I spent a lot of time as it started to cause problems. I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to explain and justify why I needed to use, you know. My first introduction to Narcotics Anonymous was because my friend Steve that I grew up with, I think about addicts before Narcotics Anonymous and what their fate was. You know, again, gratitude. How do I honor that? How do I appreciate the opportunity, the gift? I think about people today who don't live in a community where Narcotics Anonymous may be readily available. But what was going on contextually as I was growing up was in the 80s, there was kind of a growth of treatment, and also that began a growth of Narcotics Anonymous. And my friend Stephen, when he was 15, his parents sent him they told him he was going to see a doctor, and went to this place in Massachusetts and called Straight, and he was there for 13 months. And so as I was doing, you know, step work, when I was trying to figure out, am I an addict, and, you know, what's my problem? You know, you had a lot of stuff. Well, you know, you're just a kid. You're just, you know, going through a stage. You know, you're depressed. You know, I didn't know really what the issue was. But when I did step work, I started looking back and seeing powerlessness. And this was probably one of the second times, third times of powerlessness that I was able to identify. And that was, there was a genuine desire to support my friend who'd been away for 13 months. And to be, you know, a non-using friend for him when he got back. And I kept saying, tomorrow, still got a few weeks, next week, you know, and I'm using up until the time that he gets out. And the funny thing is, this leads to my introduction to Narcotics Anonymous, because I go to a meeting with him. This is like November 87, so I'm 16. It was in Kingston, Rhode Island. The name of the group was based on a movie that was popular at that time. So the name of the group was called Drug Busters. And there are a few things that I remember distinctly from that first meeting. Some of them really related to and understood, and some of it confused me. And I don't know if anyone else has been confused in Narcotics Anonymous or confused at meetings. But what I identified with was the woman who spoke, talking about life on life's terms. And it's the first time I've heard that description, and I immediately had this kind of this rebelliousness raise up in me, like, F that, you know? What do you mean life on life's terms? What do you mean acceptance? What do you mean accepting personal responsibility? Things that I just had no clue, you know, what they meant. The other thing I remember about the meeting is that the meeting was 90 minutes, and they took a break in the middle, and this is where it got confusing. So it was a smoking meeting in a church, and they took a smoke break in the middle of the meeting. I mean, that was like, that just didn't make sense to me. It was also a meeting, and this was my first impression of Narcotics Anonymous. They handed out raffle tickets, and if your ticket got pulled, that's how you share. So that's my first example. So I bounced around meetings, some, and some with a couple other younger people. I don't have much recollection of it or why. Like, I didn't have a desire to stop using. I'm not sure why I ended up in those meetings, but I know that by the time I was 18 and not welcome in my mom's home because my behavior was disruptive to my younger brother and sister, that I ended up in outpatient treatment. And I mean, it's a weird age to, you know, be 18, turning 19, and trying to figure some of this stuff out. And what I can tell you about my experience is most of it's like looking backwards and understanding it, not understanding it at the moment. And this is where I get kind of a little hesitancy. Like, if I share this now, would 19-year-old Chris get scared? Would he identify? And that is when I look back, I see the hand of God helping to guide, putting people in places, things like that, in my path. So I end up in outpatient treatment, and then in May of 1990, I go inpatient treatment. And this, you know, starts a series of things that I've looked back on. Again, I go into inpatient treatment. My single hope was that they would fix me in 30 days. They would reveal whatever the secret was that prevented me from knowing how to live life. You know? Which goes back again to that whole thing of not knowing how to live life on life's terms. You know, like I thought, they're going to do something to make my life fixed. Not understanding, not wanting to accept that, like, this is a commitment to a process and a set of practices, a set of principles. And I went in there, and I'm like, I don't really know what's wrong with me, you know. I went in there, and certain things happened. There was a guy that lived next to my mom named Paul, and Paul had gone to AA for maybe 6 months, and he didn't go to AA anymore. But he had a girlfriend, a job, and a Nintendo. And I was like, that's living, right? And what I loved about it was the short-term investment that he made to get that. 6 months. I can do 6 months. And when I'm in there, I find out Paul drank and lost those things. And so this thought comes into my head, maybe I need a different role model for recovery. The day I get out of treatment, and I'll say this, you know, AA was part of my story for the first couple of years. Part of it was there weren't NA meetings 7 days a week. Part of it was people that came into my life, and I'll talk a little bit later about why NA became my fellowship. But the day that I'm getting out of treatment, my counselor says, would you come to my AA home group and give me my 17-year chip? And for a kid that always felt on the outside and not a part of, that sure was a meaningful way for me to feel like I mattered in some way. Next day after treatment, I go to this restaurant. I ask for a job. I didn't get hired there when I was using. I ask for a job. The cook says, you can come in. I can give you part-time hours. Come in Sunday. Help me clean the restaurant. And we're sitting there and taking a break. And he looks at me. He says, you know, I've been sober 13 years in AA, and I can look another person in the eye today. I was like, I got out of treatment Wednesday, Thursday. He's like, I don't know if you know this, but we got a meeting here on Tuesdays, and people that are in the program, they hang out in the kitchen. Okay, at that time, I don't have any perspective that there's a power greater than myself working in my life. You know? I go back to Drug Busters. Now, Drug Busters has been restored to some sort of sanity because they've become a non-smoking meeting. So now the smoke break makes sense. This makes sense now. But the meeting was smaller than the first time I'd gone. So you might have 7-8 people there. You know, I remember in the early 90s there, meetings with 2 or 3 people. You know, real small fellowship, real small state. Easy to miss between Connecticut and Massachusetts. Real easy. You could nod and miss it, just like that. And so I go into this meeting, and, you know, thank you to the people that read, and thank you to the people that wrote what became our readings. You know, because as a 19-year-old, I had trouble identifying with Motorcycle Roy. You know, I had trouble identifying with Hippie John. They were older than me by a lot, you know. At least it felt like a lot, because they, like, had marriages and stuff and things that I just, you know, didn't grasp. The readings is where I found the identification. And that Drug Busters meeting, it was a basic text study. And we read, and this is interesting, we read everything in the basic text from the front to the back, or, you know, we just kept reading, with one exception. We skipped the traditions. There wasn't enough time around to even understand what the hell they were for, or what they meant, or why they mattered. And Motorcycle Roy would say, let's go to the next chapter. You know? And it's interesting to me because of how much I've come to see the traditions are not just for the group, but the traditions have great value for me and my own recovery, you know, and can benefit me greatly. But these guys, Roy and John, man, I mean, did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, they came up to me and they said, Roy said, this is your home group. Show up next Wednesday and make the coffee. There were a lot of problems with that. You want me to make a commitment to something that's a week away. I'm not confident on, I'm nervous that I'm not going to keep this. I managed to keep that commitment and show up. But I'm the only one there. I get there at 7 before the 7:30 meeting. They all come in about 7:20, so I'm left to do something I'd never done before, which was make coffee, because I'd never drank coffee at that point in my life. But it gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of purpose. I did not know how to, I was not at ease having small conversations with people. How are you? Me? But I could go and have a task, make the coffee, put out the cups, learn how to put out the IPs and the key tags, and I felt safe and that I had purpose, that I belonged somewhere. And then, I don't know if anyone has had this experience, then the kind of phase of rigidity came in. What do you mean? I make the coffee. You don't make the coffee. That's not how we organize the IPs on this table. No, that's my job. It's funny looking back at it. It talks about in step one that our disease has three parts, physical, mental, and spiritual, and the spiritual part being the self-centeredness. And I didn't even understand these things as they were happening, but the self-centeredness that played out in that first meeting that I made coffee, as I looked around, not hearing a single word that was shared, but looking at the expressions on the faces of the people that drank my first pot of coffee, and trying to decide whether they liked it or not, because that was going to be a determination of whether they liked me. If that person looks unhappy, shit. I'm not gonna talk to them. They're not gonna like me, Complete self-centeredness, self-centered fear, Self-centered fear, I am free from the obsession to use drugs. Self-centered fear still is something I wrestle with. It is still the reminder to show up and work a program to the best of my ability. John, Hippie John, says, I'm gonna be your sponsor, and he calls me up on Saturday. And I will share this. I hate sharing this. I cringe when I share this. But I'll share it. I grew up dating Catholic girls, which posed a very unique problem for a young guy in Rhode Island. So shortly after, within 10 days of getting out of treatment, I persuade my Catholic girlfriend, and it finally happens. And the phone rings, and it's John. And John says, hey man, I need you to come over and help me move stuff. Now it says in here, on page 88, we do not have to understand this program for it to work. All we have to do is follow direction. I am so sorry, but I've got to go. My sponsor just called and needs help moving. Cringe at that story, but it is my experience. I show up at John's with the expectation that the following weekend I might be cutting his grass, painting. I just did not know. I thought this was the reciprocation for his sponsorship. As most things, as I said, it's looking back and understanding what was actually happening after the event. And looking back, all he was doing was spending time with me while he was getting things he needed to get done. He didn't need me to help move anything. But he drove around while we did those things and talked to me about his sponsor and how he got introduced to the steps and how he wanted to start working the steps with me and started doing step work with him. I got back into school at the University of Rhode Island. I majored in psychology. As I got a little bit of recovery, I began to kind of gain this insight that I'd majored in psychology because I was familiar with it. I was familiar with seeing counselors. And so I didn't know what to do. You know, I'm getting ready to graduate, and they let me do an internship. And I wasn't seeking to do it at a treatment center or anything, but of the three places, that's where I ended up. And then they gave me a job at that place. And the guy with the most amount of time in NA, he had probably at that time about 8-9 years. And it just, I mean, that just seemed like unbelievable. And he said, Chris, if you do any of this work, like, that's not your program. That's not your recovery. But I did that work. I ended up deciding to move to North Carolina in 1994. I was dating a girl that was going to school down there. And I ended up going to an inpatient psychiatric facility for a job interview. The director of nursing was not impressed with me. But the person whose position was open, she was going from inpatient to outpatient, and she was from Rhode Island, and she was homesick, so she wanted me to come back to meet this woman. So I come back to meet this woman, and she worked at the treatment center I'd gone through in Rhode Island. And I get the job simply because of that, not because of any qualifications or effort or anything, just grace. The reason that that was important is that it allowed me to meet a guy who would become the founder of the nonprofit that I work at. And so I went to work for this nonprofit, this homeless shelter that serves individuals with addiction in 2000. And I've been there for over 21 years, you know. First as an intern, then as a staff member, and since 2016 as the executive director. And the same thing that Steve S. told me in 1994, you know, like, the work is no substitution for a program or recovery. So when I moved to North Carolina, I joined the Just for Today home group, which is still my home group today. It's part of the New Hope area in Durham. I met a man named Randall and asked him to be my sponsor. It was really difficult at that time for me to maintain a sponsorship relationship long distance. I had a sponsee move to Florida maybe 10 years ago, and he was kind of like, will you still sponsor me? And I was basing that all on my kind of experience with, 1994, making that transition. And I didn't realize that technology had improved. And so I was like, well, yeah, I guess I could. We could Skype and things like that. So I didn't say this. I alluded to it. I want to come back to it. So I remember a couple things. I remember being in a meeting with a couple years of recovery, and it sounded like everybody who was sharing had incredible conscious contact with the power greater than themselves. And I just didn't feel that. And I had... tried practicing prayer and things like that. And I had the thought that maybe I'm in the wrong place, maybe I should leave. And this voice came into my head, the thought, voice, whatever, came to my head and said, if you leave now, you'll never know. And it gave me, at that moment, kind of this realization that if I don't stick around, and give this a chance, who knows, and I'm very grateful for that kind of turning point. Again, there's so many of these points where things could go on one way or the other. But pro- probably by about 2.5 years in recovery, I made Narcotics Anonymous my home. And one of the reasons for that was the identification with the program, the commitment that I had with a sponsor and a home group. But I also heard people talking about Narcotics Anonymous like it was a second-class program. And the people that would get time in up in Rhode Island, the people who got time would end up in AA. And it was kind of like people are going to AA once they get some time so they can keep real recovery. And I had this thought that, shit, if everyone who gets time decides to leave NA, how's NA ever going to get any time, you know? And this is what has saved me, and I want to be here, you know. And that was the thinking at that time. Since then, there's so many things that I've come to understand and recognize through working the steps and so forth. But you know, we deal with the condition of addiction. You know, we don't talk about it, you know, being powerless over a particular drug. You know, and it creates room for all of us to be in here to identify around the issues of obsession and compulsion and self-centeredness and fear and hope and faith. So I got a new sponsor in Durham. One of the first things that he helped me with that was really big was I was coming up on 5 years of recovery, and I was still having bouts of depression, and a psychiatrist recommended an antidepressant for me. And I remember meeting with my sponsor outside of a Golden Corral before our home group and saying, this doctor wants me to take a medication for depression. Can I still be a member of Narcotics Anonymous? And he's like, of course you can. You know, this is not an addictive drug that you're taking, it's, you know. And he shared his own experience with it. But that was that, you know, that fear of, you know, and really kind of the culture in recovery at that time. You know, that, and what it led me to realize is that Narcotics Anonymous has not been the solution to every problem that I have. But without Narcotics Anonymous, I would never be able to benefit from anything else. So the other forms of outside help that I've needed over the times, you know, like I got married in recovery, I got divorced in recovery. It was shocking to see the issues that came up under the lens of a marriage that I thought I had worked through, and that I thought that I had addressed, and to feel like I was 15 years again in terms of how I was dealing with things, just minus the drugs. At times like that, I found the fact that I was involved with a sponsorship family, involved with sponsoring others, that how much a sponsee can help save you. And I would say, but I'm ashamed that I'm going through this. I'm ashamed that, because I never wanted to be like my dad, you know. And they'd say, Chris, but you're staying clean. And you're living life with the challenges and problems that come up with it. And so my sponsor had also kind of taught me or shared with me early on, you know, we went through my second sponsor, the one that I have now, we went through the book, we worked the steps, but he would say to me, in the interest of your recovery, it's important for you to have a home group because that's a place for you to make a commitment to help carry a message as a group to the addict who still suffers. And that type of commitment will mean that you have a place where you belong. But there are going to be times when you are out of sorts with your home group. So it's really important that you have a sponsor. And he talked about the reasons why I needed to have a sponsor. He says, but you shouldn't just have that, because there's going to be times where you're going to be unhappy with things that I share with you. So you should have a fellowship of people that are part of your network. And he just kind of kept going on. You should read literature. You should practice prayer and meditation and try to improve that practice. You should get involved in service work. You should do H&I. You should do various, you know, other forms of service work. The message he was telling me is that there might be a failure point with some of those things at different times. And if I'm only using one or two of those, I have nothing else to keep me tied to the program. And interestingly, a guy that I sponsor passed in November with 36 years of recovery. And at one point, he was my grand sponsor. And my sponsor had a falling out with him. And during that period, I had a lot of disagreements with my sponsor. I didn't see eye to eye with him on that issue, and it made it difficult to connect. And those things that he said about being tied to the program through these suggestions really helped me recognize the importance that, you know, over-reliance on just one or two things is probably not a good recipe for sustained recovery. I've been blessed to have developed an interest in understanding where we come from and who helped, whose service work helped me have this opportunity today. Like, if the basic text had not been written when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I'm not sure if I would have gotten clean. I don't know if I would have found enough identification in the white book. And that interest has led me to have a relationship with my friend Boyd, who's been in recovery since 87. And without any plan or objective besides, one, recognizing that without Narcotics Anonymous, neither of us would have been here, that our lives would not have meaning and purpose, how easy it would have been to be an addict at a different time and have a very awful fate. And we should appreciate that. And that's kind of what we bonded around, and also around the fact that in NA, we just don't have a real good way to share history, to preserve history. In 2021, I spent a lot of time in Alabama, in Tennessee, in Georgia, in Florida, without leaving North Carolina. A man named Motorcycle Ed, second guy who's a motorcycle guy, sent Boyd and I two boxes of archives, and he says, you know, I've come to a place where I'm not sure what's going to happen to me, but I want to make sure that these remain. And I spent April till October, November, digitizing 1,000 separate items from his archives and cataloging them and seeing Out of the Darkness Into the Light programs from 1999, seeing the handwritten flyers from the 80s for different events, learning about the Alabama, Northwest, Florida region. And so it's really exciting to be here with you, having felt like I've spent a lot of time seeing what types of activities addicts were doing in the 80s to help carry a message and help people stay clean. The history work that Boyd and I have done has allowed us to travel to about 28 different states. One of our most meaningful presentations was being invited by the Hole in the Wall group to the Oregon State Penitentiary and to do a presentation and to learn about the fact that they have a waiting list for the NA meeting there based on the demand and the culture and how meaningful and powerful it is. We've done the presentation in a couple other countries, in Japan and Ghana. Who would have thought that Narcotics Anonymous would provide a vehicle to see so much of the world and to see addicts and to learn about the things that they do and the unique expressions that they have, what recovery's like in their community. You know, I remember being in Louisiana maybe 10 years ago and hearing about the hours spent driving, you know, to meetings. And it is enriching, and it is a gift, and it is a blessing. And my prayer today, you know, I start my day with the third step prayer, but my prayer is also allow me to please protect and savor this gift that I've been given today. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.